Good morning.
Wow, it's a beautiful day.
It is.
Sunshine.
Beautiful day in the neighborhood.
We got a lot of fun today. This is going to be fun.
Oh, we do. First of all, we're going to have Greg Palast.
Yes, we are.
At 8 o'clock.
I like having him on the show.
Oh, he is so sharp, man. He is one of the best journalists. You know, he's moved to New York. He's in the United States. He's active. He's wild. He's going to be doing a benefit for KABU thing on Monday next week.
That's true. He'll be here in town.
I wonder if they're going to let KABU people be on the stage with Tom Hartman.
Perhaps. Can you call Palast a journalist? I mean, he's neither fair nor balanced.
You can. Journalism is not fair or balanced. By the mere selection of what it chooses to report, it is biased.
But it's fair and balanced on that network.
What, Fox?
That one, yeah.
The cheering section for the failed Bush administration?
Yeah. You're with me.
Oh, yeah. I guess we're not fair and balanced either. No, yes, the answer is he's a journalist. He's a good one. Damn good one.
Yeah.
And he has gone to the heart of many matters, and I have lots of stuff for him when he comes to
see
us. And what do you got?
I got some stuff about the growing flap over the FBI raid on Congressman Jefferson's office.
Yes.
In Washington, but we'll get to that in a minute. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I want to do my belated Memorial Day salute.
Okay.
Which, of course, unfortunately, thanks to the Bush administration, is a Memorial Day dump on the heroes of previous wars and present wars. GI Bill of Rights, by the way, was signed during World War II. It was a response to the failure to fulfill the promises made to veterans during World War I.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually vetoed by Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it passed anyway. I grabbed the site, which I think is awolbush.com. Great site, by the way. Great site on the net. Bush administration has cut $1.5 billion from military family housing. $1.5 billion, which is $3,000 it's horrible. It's horrible. To be a military family, particularly a general enlistee, is to suffer. The Bush Republicans support millionaires instead of military veterans. You know, this is true. Bush allies in Congress stopped efforts to scale back the tax cuts for the nation's millionaire by just 5%. They continue to cut back on the costs of taxation for the rich and really hit the working class, including GIs. Bush administration has underfunded the veterans' health care by $2 billion. Now, this is very relevant. I was with a group of old buddies, and one of them is a veteran, and he was telling me how the Veterans Administration hospital, when he went to the hospital, charged him $1,500. $1,500 for services, which normally would have been paid for as a veteran. You know, that's part of that GI Bill of Rights. So they're really cutting. I mean, it's really affecting working people.
I thought the president supported the troops.
The president supports the troops to going to Iraq or Afghanistan or soon Iran, as far as it goes to the extent that they become cannon fodder, and that's it.
But the aircraft carrier and the cod piece.
The aircraft carrier and the cod piece?
Yeah.
You mean...
You could see his support for the troops.
You could see his cod piece. That's about it. Bush administration's proposed ending health care benefits for 173,000 veterans. Cutting them off. Just cutting them off. Huh. That's how my friend got screwed over. The administration budget cuts force more than 200,000 veterans to wait for health care, delaying health care for them. 200,000. See.
On what grounds is he doing this?
We have to reduce the deficit.
Reduce spending.
Reduce spending.
Okay. Small government and all that.
Small government, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So, it's just, to me, it's incredible. And the administration opposed a plan to give National Guard and Reserve members access to health insurance. Again, to cut spending. And he cut $172 million allotted for educating the children of military personnel. The children.
Well, see, the better to make them into future military personnel.
You mean ignorant people make better soldiers?
Right. See, he's being farsighted there.
Well,
got to give him some credit.
And the tax cut denies military families increases in child tax credits. That's a little sidebar of that. This is all the stuff that the Bush administration. This is my Memorial Day celebration.
That's awful. How do they get away with cloaking themselves in the flag and all this rhetoric about honoring the military and the glories of service and sacrifice and all that?
Why do you hate America so much? See, that's how they get away with
question
it.
Question might, yeah, you're right.
That's
might
how they get away with it. What they do is instead of directly dealing with the issues, they create some kind of patriotic weirdness, and a whole bunch of American people knee-jerkingly respond to that. That's how they get away with it.
Yeah, see, I hear stuff like this, and it just makes me really mad at John Kerry.
John Kerry? You're going to pick on John Kerry?
Yeah, John Kerry.
Why John Kerry?
Listen, if I had been running John Kerry's campaign, he would have won. Because he would have, you know, he would have turned this stuff, he would have thrown statistics like that back in the president's face. And he would not have allowed himself to be slapped around the way he was slapped around.
Okay. I'm going to let that go. You need more? You want more?
I want more. Give me more.
Okay, here's more. Two students in Texas thought it would be a fun idea to get their teachers stoned, so they made these muffins, I think it was, with marijuana.
You have no idea how many times I hatched that same plan.
But you didn't do it.
No.
Okay, they did it. The teachers didn't know they were getting marijuana. They got sick. Some of them, I mean, I don't know what the dose was or the quality of the dope or whatever. They got sick, some of them. They thought they were going crazy. Bad. Mm-hmm. Bad thing to do. Okay, so serious crime. You would think that these kids would be kicked out of school.
Sure.
Have to write letters of apology. Maybe have to do some community service.
Sure.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe have to go to the drug counseling.
Yeah, rehab.
Rehab. Yeah, some, sure. You know, no. You see, this is a crime under the, apparently this was a crime that the FBI has become involved in as part of the anti-terrorism thing. I'm not kidding.
Kids who slip dope to their teachers.
Well, they said 18 people in the hospital.
Terrorists.
It triggered an FBI terrorism investigation.
Really?
I guess Tom Potter, necessary because, you know, the FBI has to make sure it knows what's going on everywhere.
Right.
Schools, city halls.
Especially subversive city halls like Portland.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, this is Little Beirut.
Right.
Right? And then, oh, man.
Building too many bike lanes.
Oh, man. I got even more stuff. You want more?
Yeah.
All right. Here's a letter to the editor. Actually, I want to save this
For
last.
Okay.
So tell us what the horrendous discoveries you made over the weekend.
Well, it's like so many discoveries with this administration.
It's hard to keep up, isn't it?
It would be a lot funnier if things weren't quite so bad.
You know, on the other hand, maybe this is karma.
Could be.
For the, you know, slaughter of the Native Americans, the enslavement of African Americans. Maybe this is just kind of the
great wheel coming around.
Yeah, the cosmic evening out.
Could be.
I don't know. I don't want to sound unpatriotic here, because I am a patriot. I love this country.
Yeah, me too.
Isn't that weird?
It is.
You know, here we are loving this country and feeling very angry with the policies of the current administration and being filled with despair and having all these fancy-ass analyses. And we don't hear enough from conservatives, you know that? I want to hear from veterans.
I want to hear from veterans, too.
Veterans.
But interesting you should bring that up, because in less than 2 weeks...
Yes.
There's an event that comes around that allows us all to be unabashedly, full-throatedly patriotic.
What's that?
The World Cup.
The World... You mean watching paint dry on a field?
No. See? See, you know...
I like baseball, so if I like baseball, I regard soccer as watching paint dry, think of how unactive... Well, I mean, come on.
I wouldn't expect someone like you to be able to grasp the more sublime beauties of soccer, Joe.
Yeah, right.
Maybe you should watch a match.
Peeing, standing in a crowd, peeing, and then beating people up afterward.
No. Those are fans. That's not the game.
Oh.
Maybe you and I should watch a match. But see, anyway, you know, all the other stuff drips away when the World Cup comes around because those
drips
are...
Drips away.
Yeah, slips away, whatever. Because those are our boys out there, you know? You can cheer for them.
Our boys! Our boys!
All right, well, enough of that.
All right.
Okay, 231-8187 is the number to call. This is KBOO 90.7 FM.
I'm glad you reminded people of that, because
They
might think we're just blathering.
Because some people say we talk too much.
We do talk.
Believe it or not.
Well, they pay us. Don't they pay us?
No.
Oh, wait a minute. We're not being paid?
No, I've been...
All right, sorry.
I've been cashing your checks, man.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so if you recall, last week we talked about Representative William Jefferson from Louisiana.
Yes. They call him... Dollar Bill.
Dollar Bill.
No, they do. In Louisiana, they call him Dollar
that's
Bill.
That's good.
Yeah, that's really true.
Why? Do you ask why they call him Dollar Bill? Because allegedly he was handed $100,000 in cash by an FBI agent.
I wonder if they actually marked those bills.
Well, it turns out they didn't have to because they found him later individually wrapped, or actually in bundles, in
bundles.
His
freezer.
See?
Cold storage, man. Cold cash.
Yeah. I wonder if you put money in the freezer, does that preserve its value longer? Is it less likely to
this is the guy who came out of poverty. Yeah. Went to Harvard Law School, I believe, mm-hmm. and actually ended up in Congress and had only one negative propensity. Actually, a good congressman, all in all. One negative propensity.
To take bribes.
Yes. Apparently, allegedly.
That's a pretty big negative propensity.
Maybe they're just picking on him because he's African American.
Perhaps. But
I don't think so. Sorry.
If we assume for a moment that these allegations are true, he did, in fact, take a briefcase full of cash from an FBI agent.
Yeah, but
so that would tend to transcend the color issue.
But then the FBI used that as an excuse to raid the offices of a congressperson in session.
Yes, they did.
That's a constitutional no-no.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is there anything in the Constitution that says
you can't
raid a...
Yeah, not that you can't raid an office, but that they're sacrosanct.
Sacrosanct, but that's an issue that's up for debate right now. Apparently in 220-some-odd years of our republic, there has never been a law enforcement raid on the office of a congressperson.
Right, but apparently there is in the Constitution a thing about not arresting them, actually.
Exactly, but that's not the same as not searching them. It seems to have been more a question of custom and respect for the office rather than any actual constitutional
precedent.
Right, so... But all this is happening against a rather interesting backdrop, and that, of course, is the widening investigation into the exploits of Randy Duke Cunningham.
Hey,
the Dukester from
California.
From San Diego, right. And we've talked about the Dukester again and again and again.
We love the Dukester.
We do.
He cried.
He did.
I'm going to jail.
So earlier this month, around the time of the growing flap over Congressman Jefferson, we discovered that the Cunningham case was expanding. And that the federal investigators on the case were requesting more and more documents from various members of Congress as a part of their probe into whether or not other members of Congress were involved in the same shenanigans as the Dukester. And basically the response from Congress and leadership was, no, you're asking for too much information. This is how the New York Times described this back in the middle of the month, May 16th. Justice Department investigators and lawyers for the House are wrangling over a request by the department for congressional committee documents related to its expanding inquiry into the bribery scheme that involved former Representative Randy Cunningham. The United States Attorney's Office in San Diego has asked for copies of, quote, tens of thousands of documents from the House Appropriations and Intelligence Committees.
Well, that's just wrong.
Right. As part of its inquiry into whether Cunningham illegally influenced the process of the committees used to designate money for military projects. But lawyers for the Republican-controlled House rebuffed the request as unreasonably broad, the official said, and asked the United States Attorney's Office for a shorter list. So then Speaker Denny Hastert, a Republican, goes on record opposing the search of Jefferson's office on the grounds that it's constitutionally impermissible.
Yes.
He's taking the moral high ground here.
Yes.
But you got to wonder why. And this would appear to explain...
Oh, you're so cynical.
Why? Because he's afraid that FBI agents are going to come knocking on his office next.
Well, he understands precedent and its impact on his future.
Yeah.
Being out of jail and stuff.
He's making what I think is a specious argument. And he wants to clip the investigators' wings on the best terms now before they can search his office and those of his compatriots.
Why do you hate America so much?
So here's something said on the floor of the House by Representative Barney Frank of Massachusetts.
Barney Frank.
One of my favorite guys.
I like Barney Frank.
This is what he said.
He has no chance of being president.
No, he does not.
Okay.
Madam Speaker, this is Frank talking on the floor of the House. Madam Speaker, I disagree with the bipartisan House leadership's criticism of the FBI search of a member's office. I know nothing specifically about the case except that the uncontroverted public evidence did seem to justify the issuance of a warrant. What we now have is a congressional leadership, the Republican part of which has said it's okay for law enforcement to engage in warrantless searches of the average citizen, now objecting when a search pursuant to a validly issued warrant is conducted of a member of Congress. So there you have it. This same Congress has defended the president's right to do whatever the hell he wants, whenever he wants.
But not to Congress.
Yeah, but all of a sudden the Justice Department is looking into possible criminal activity on behalf of the House, and now all of a sudden they want to stand on constitutional principle. Well, it stinks!
Well, you just don't like the hypocrisy of it. You don't understand how things work.
I guess I don't.
No. You're extremely deliberately naive.
Maybe congresspeople should be volunteers like us.
Volunteers like us?
Yeah, we don't get paid here at KBOO.
Wait a minute. I don't understand. You mean I'm doing this for nothing?
You're doing this for nothing.
What's the reward?
You're doing it for ego gratification.
That's the reward?
Is your reward, yeah. So 231-8187, give us a call. Let us know how you feel about this government's abandonment of the military.
Maybe and, people could just give me cash and I could tell how wonderful they are or something. Am I now soliciting a bribe?
Could be.
Is that a crime?
Well, I don't think you actually solicited one. You kind of hinted that you might be available.
Oh, yeah.
To get grant a bribe.
I've been looking at the second season of Deadwood.
Good show, man.
Oh, isn't that a good show?
Oh, yeah, really good
but
show.
But be aware, folks. It is involves full frontal nudity occasionally and obscenities galore.
Oh, yeah, like every other word. Amazing.
Yeah. But it's in Shakespearean, almost a Shakespearean plot with an incredible use of late Victorian language. Brilliant.
Oh, yeah, there's soliloquies that seem right out. It's incredible.
It's straight out of Shakespeare.
All right, so 231-8187. I'm Abe. That's Joe.
I'm Joe.
Very soon
that's
now,
Abe.
We're going to have
Greg Palast. And we do want calls.
It sounds like we got a call.
Hey, Bill?
Bill, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. I'm a veteran, and I believe you boys, a couple of them, are academic cocksuckers.
Okay, you can't say that one.
And did we hit the button? We have a button now.
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know if she caught that.
Okay.
We have a button to stop that stuff now, folks.
Don't call up and say that.
Say that. That's really nasty.
That was stupid.
That's besides which, he doesn't know my personal habits at all.
And frankly, Bill, that sounded like a fake accent. So whoever you are, you're a coward.
Cowardly
so
accent.
Let it go. Coward.
We do want to hear from veterans, and we are serious about that. We have... this is another item along that same line. There was this myth created by the right wing that veterans returning home from the war of Vietnam were spat upon and cursed.
But it was a myth.
It was a myth. I have talked to innumerable veterans. That is to say, I didn't count them, hence innumerable. But lots of veterans. I have looked at the research. I have examined it. There are no documented cases. Now, maybe it happened somewhere sometime.
But yeah, it certainly wasn't the epidemic it was made out to be.
No. And most of the veterans felt like abandoned, particularly by the VA.
Yeah.
You know, as I point out, that's customary. And, you know, I think that this is a nice mythology. Makes people feel like they've been abused. It gives them a reason to stay to the right, you know.
Right.
It's kind of a little bit Hitlerian in that respect.
It still amazes me, though, how the Republican Party has managed to maintain this house of cards it's constructed about how much it is in support of the average soldier. And the average person. But really, all they're in support of is the sacrifice of average soldiers for the aims of its donor class.
The chief problem, of the Democrats is that they are so anxious to win office that they will go anywhere politically and do anything politically to get into power, which means they have no content to their message. And then they talk about their message. And this is, you know, it's Bill Clinton's administration that started this process or made it fulsome and complete. So in a lot of ways, apart from other issues with Clinton, charming fellow, bright man, it's clear to me, at least, that they abandoned the New Deal totally. And in that process, abandon any possibility of social democracy in America. And to move to the center to the extent they did was to move to the right. And the result is setting it up for these fascists.
But they're fooling themselves. They think that that was the strategy that led to their electoral victories in 92 and 96. But that wasn't it at all. It was the fact that they had a towering, dominating political personality in the person of Bill Clinton.
Yeah, I think if he'd run on a social democratic ticket, particularly in the second election, he would have won.
Yeah, he would have won. And frankly, one of his latter...
the only reason they won in the first election, of course, was that Ross Perot was there.
Ross Perot, yeah.
The populist.
Yeah, open up the hood and tinker and giant sucking sound and all that. Yeah. He turned out to be absolutely right.
On the sucking
about
sound.
About the sucking
now,
sound.
Now, the hood, I don't know.
I don't know. But Bill Clinton, one of his later State of the Union addresses, I want to say maybe 98 or so, was miraculous. It was he spelled out the fulfillment of the social contract in pretty much every way I've ever imagined it being fulfilled. I mean, it was something he could never achieve politically, but it let me know that whatever sacrifices he had made politically in order to gain office, it seemed to me that his heart was in the right place. I'm sure you all are going to call up and say, who cares? But... I don't know. In a different time, a different climate, Bill Clinton may have been...
There's a weakness to his core.
A greatness.
There's a weakness to his core. Charming man, brilliant man, weak to the core. Married Hillary.
But Hillary
had a big yellow suit on the other day, and she was, this is true, she wore a yellow suit, and she was kind of imitating Gore on the environmental issues. She wants to be president in the worst way.
Yeah, she does.
And I'd love to see a woman president, but not at the cost of everything else.
No, she still supports the war. She's never once...
She said she was
otherwise.
Willing to make deals on abortion.
Yeah, she's...
She has no center. She has no call. All right. Hey, I think we got another caller.
Arthur, good morning.
Hey, Arthur, how are you?
Arthur.
Oh, hello.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hey, you know, people who hate homosexuals?
I know some of them, referring to
like the previous caller, I just would like to point out that, according to the Bible, Sodom and Gomorrah were brought to ruin because of the heterosexual community there, not the homosexual community. Did you know that?
No, that's certainly not the party line, is it?
No, it's not.
Well, I noticed in that story, actually, it's a very interesting story, because the good guys in that story, Lot and his family, were willing to give their daughters for rape and other bad purposes to the mob to save one of God's angels.
I don't think it was, that's the point to me of this story is, because if you figure, heterosexuals, their perversions are far greater. The brutality, the bigotry, the intolerance, the murderous, when it's time to go to war, well, by God, we're going to go and murder.
Well, now, I think in fairness, and seriously, I don't think any particular orientation has a special dispensation or a special quality.
Well, God got really mad. He got mad at them for something. And who do you think would cause the worst trouble in Sodom and Gomorrah, which were, they were a murderous society. They were it was inhumane. And so, I guess, if you look at it, figuratively or literally, it was the heterosexuals, not the homosexuals, that brought down Sodom and Gomorrah. What do you think of that, caller?
Okay, thanks for the call, man.
Okay.
Thanks, Arthur.
I don't think we're going to go there. Let's not have a debate about whether gay people are better or worse in their morality than straight people. Because you know what I think? I think it's kind of like having debates about skin color or sex, that is gender, or height, or eye color. You know what I mean?
Theology. Or
yeah, it's kind of irrelevant.
Yeah,
there are bad and good gay folk.
Yeah,
I think
there's bad and good types of all folk.
Red-haired guys like you.
Well, we're mostly bad.
What?
We're mostly bad.
231-8187. It is Talk Radio. It is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. This is Joe. That is Abe. And very soon, Greg Palast.
Yeah. So we have a couple of subjects out on the table.
Oh,
One is the administration's disregard for veterans.
Yeah, and
for rank and file veterans.
And I have to say, in fairness, this is an honorable tradition of screwing over the veterans.
Yeah.
We have always done this. You lots of promises. Go to war. GI Bill. GI Bill actually, by the way, changed the social fabric of America for the period of time that it lasted. It produced the huge middle class, in large part, produced a huge middle class post-war. It essentially put a lot of people in college. It created a lot of housing. It created the huge size of the public higher educational institutions, the universities and colleges. It in essence built the America that all of us have grown up with.
Yeah,
very important.
Yep. It also laid the groundwork for the great intellectual and cultural changes of the 1960s.
Yeah, it did. Ironically.
And
yeah. I think that it's underappreciated in that respect. It was not a deliberate consequence on the part of most of the people who supported veterans' rights and the GI Bill of Rights, but it was a consequence nonetheless. Okay, we're gonna say to folks who are calling right now to hold back on your calls because we're gonna have Greg Palast on very shortly.
Yep. I think we have one more caller.
We have one caller. Do we have time for the call? Yeah, we do.
Sure. Good morning. Who are you? What's your name? Hello.
I think they heard what I said and they dropped off.
Crapshoot this morning, isn't it?
Excuse me.
Crapshoot.
That's a game that's played with dice.
Right. See, I'm referring to the hit or miss aspect of whether or not there'll actually be a caller on the air. It's a metaphor, man. Work with me here. All right.
Why do you hate America so much?
I don't hate America so much. Speaking of the GI Bill.
Yes.
Okay, this is
let's focus.
Right. I think that future generations may look back at those immediate post-war decades as a time when we had it within our grasp.
It
meaning a permanent blossoming of the middle class and intellectual ripening of a big swath of society.
And the working, class is such a confusing concept in America, but the working class, which became a middle class.
Right, and educated.
Educated, and they could send their, but the thing is they could work like a General Motors, guaranteed retirement, they thought. Good wages under horrendous conditions, but good wages. Mm-hmm. Their children could go to, could go all the way through graduate school.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And they had health care.
Right.
And they were treated with respect.
Yep.
And they had power, political power.
They did. And a higher education didn't cost nearly as much as it did today, proportionally. We had something truly great there, historically unprecedented, in our grasp, and we managed to piss a lot of it away.
But we also had a Cold War where we lived in absolute terror of nuclear catastrophe.
Yes, and we spent lots and lots of money doing that. But at the same time, we were able to afford all this other stuff. So this argument right now that we can't afford to take care of our citizenry because... you know, simply not enough wealth is specious at best.
Oh, well, you can't afford it if you're going to create a tax structure that doesn't tax the rich.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, as tax rates have declined since the end of the Second World War, so has the lot of the working class declined. I'm talking tax rates on the most wealthy Americans.
Well, it's really clear that the tax system is reactionary and retrograde. You know,
it is.
And instead of being a progressive. Progressive taxation means, of course, that the more you have, the more you give.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, some people have a lot. Really a lot.
They do.
I mean, a lot.
Really more now than in any other time in history. Since the Gilded Age of the late 1800s.
Well, yeah.
Since the first excesses of the industrial era.
Exactly. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
And I think that... I think most Americans are mystified on this. They don't understand the degree to which the upper classes are getting a free ride on the shoulders of working people.
Yeah. And they just got another tax cut last week.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
And there seems to be no end to this. Meanwhile, future generations bear the burden of this war and other wars and other disasters. The Bush administration significantly sells out the environment, sells out everything. With their particular and out front, but yet somehow hidden goals. When we get Greg Palast on the air, he'll talk about that.
When you're understanding this knee-jerk anti-tax faction that's out there, it's important to understand that there's nothing behind their strategy but an ideology that says we must pay fewer taxes. There's nothing behind it at all. Remember, George...
Well, wait a minute. There is something behind it because the tax burden shifts to the poorer people. It hurts.
It does hurt, but I'm saying it's just straight greed from the richest perspective. Remember Bush's first term where he was campaigning against Al Gore? He said, we have to cut taxes because the surplus is so big.
Well, he took care of that, didn't
he? And so he cut taxes, and the deficit got huge. And then he said, we've got to cut taxes so that the economy will be stimulated and we can reduce the deficit. So he cut taxes when the government's got too much money, and you cut them when the government doesn't have nearly enough money. He just cut them. That's all it's about.
Well, I think the Bush administration actually has an agenda that's very clear, and it has to do with serving the interests of a certain set of the very wealthiest in America.
It's donor class. It's the donor class.
It's, well, you know, the Republican rich. Hey, you know what? We're going to have Greg Palast on the air.
Hey, Greg Palast, what's going on?
I don't know. You tell me. The regime.
Yeah,
the regime.
I actually, Greg, I wanted to, first of all, welcome you. I'm always glad to have you on the air. I want to remind people you're going to be in town on Monday is the 6th?
No. On Monday the 5th.
5th. Oh, sorry.
Stop messing with the calendar, man.
I can't help it. Okay, and I wanted to, if you don't mind, there's a letter to the editor in the Monday paper, Monday the 22nd, by a guy named Leif Clark.
Better tell us which paper.
The Times, the New York Times. And
yes,
I'd like to read it to you because I think it's a good kickoff point for a lot of what I suspect you might want to say. To the editor, Paul Krugman in D for Debacle, a column of May 15th, quotes John DiIulio, former head of President Bush's faith-based initiative, as saying, what you've got is everything, and I mean everything, being run by the political arm. The entire American population, and perhaps conservatives most of all, have been spun by this administration from the beginning with bait-and-switch efforts, puffery, scare tactics, and hype. We rightly bemoan the incompetence, the arrogance, and the indifference of this administration. But what Americans need to focus on, if they value their democracy, is that this is not a purposeless government. From the beginning, it has achieved with ruthless efficiency its most cherished goal, to make businesses more profitable and less accountable, and to make the rich fabulously richer. It is sickening to see how this crowd has intentionally transferred American tax dollars directly out of the pockets of the middle class, pardon me, and into the pockets and into the coffers of greedy businesses and selfish millionaires. On that score, the Bush administration has been frighteningly competent. Now, isn't this part of what you've been saying recently a lot?
Not at all.
No. Oh, okay.
No.
Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you next time.
Good introduction. Okay.
No, see, there's a difference.
Okay.
Two things. One, my point is I'm an investigative reporter, right?
So gotcha. And a good one.
This guy believes the administration has bent the entire force of the American Republic from its military to its treasury to the enrichment of a small elite.
Okay.
What I have here in our madhouse is 400 pages of the evidence and the documents and the information.
Wow.
In other words, the idea is that the problem, for those who don't know me, I do investigative reporting for BBC TV and the Guardian papers of Britain, which, of course, investigative reporting is illegal under Patriot Act 3 in America, so I do it from abroad. And it's in our madhouse, which will be launched. International launch will be in Portland on June 5. And by the way, that's at 6:30 p.m., sponsored by Portland Alliance and the Oregon Voting Rights Coalition at the First Unitarian Universalist Church at 12th Street.
Mm-hmm. And KABU, we're sponsoring it too.
And KABU.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Darn.
And I noticed that...
So you're part of the bad attitude crew. What we're going to do, Abe and Joe and I are going to be holding an armed madhouse class war boot camp. See, the whole book's title, and I'm going to take a breath, which is to do the entire subtitle. So, you know, our mass, who's afraid of Osama? Well, China floats, Bush sinks, the scheme to steal 08, No Child Behind left, and other dispatches from the front lines of the class war.
Wait.
That's the longest subtitle in history.
I'm going to have to ask you to repeat that subtitle.
Backwards. No. Not going to ask you to repeat
that. Armed madhouse.
Who's afraid of Osama? It's armed madhouse.
Uh-huh.
After, by the way, the Ginsburg's Howl 50th anniversary this week.
I actually published a review of that book about that in the Oregonian this last Sunday.
The line, the soul should never die ungodly in an armed madhouse. So armed madhouse, who's afraid of Osama Wolf? War on terror, China floats, Bush sinks, the currency game, the scheme to steal 2008. For those conspiracy nuts out there who think John Kerry won, that chapter is called Kerry Won with the evidence.
Yeah.
No Child Behind left about class war taken to the classroom. And it includes everything from what really happened in New Orleans, which I don't even want to tell you right now, and other dispatches from the front lines of the class war. And that's what that guy was talking about, which is there's an omerta in the U.S. press, a vow of silence over the class war that's been declared by this regime. And what I do is to try to give you the documents you're not supposed to see about how they're conducting that war. For example, when he says, very important point of that reader, for those... by the way, if you want to see the BBC TV reports that are too dangerous, or you go to www.gregpalace.com and get them in real time. BBC keeps up all my reports for American viewers on their machines because they know that you can't see them. Yeah, it's a special deal I have with BBC because they know that we're blacked out. All my reports, by the way, for BBC, for anything by Greg Palace, is available to ABC television for free. But the price is too high. That is the political price. It's owned by Disney, right?
Yeah.
And
the mouse.
And they ain't going to do anything that's going to discomfort the powers that be, of which they are some. Well, anyway.
Yeah, go ahead.
Like, for example, in the book we have we have the inside documents, the secret documents for the, you know, I know some of you have conspiracy nuts out there who think that Bush had a plan for seizing Iraq's oil before the tanks rolled, but that's not true. There are two plans. We got both in the book, and we actually show you key pages from each.
Wow.
The key thing, see, when people say that Bush is screwed up, they do not understand. And I like this guy that wrote the letter to the Times.
Uh-huh.
He hasn't screwed up, okay? What you will see is that in a 323-page plan written up by executives and retainers of big oil companies out of Houston, this plan was imposed upon Washington, or I should say handed by, interestingly enough, by the Council on Foreign Relations to Dick Cheney,
mm-hmm.
which was then handed to the State Department, which was then shoved down at gunpoint of the government we installed in Iraq, which said, here's how you're going to run your oil industry, and it's going to be run in a manner which will, quote, enhance the new Iraq government's relationship with OPEC. In other words, we're supporting the oil cartel, which is squeezing us by the pumps. They don't want you to see this. It was top of nightly news in BBC. I literally held up the document.
Hmm.
All over the world. This was like big news. Not here. But in our madhouse, I've got it because I want you to see what you're otherwise denied seeing. But the key thing is that for those who thought we went into Iraq, you know, blood for oil, no blood for oil. Well, you know, most Americans think blood for oil is a bargain. We didn't go in for the oil. We went to not get the oil.
Stop a second. Yeah. Are you arguing that essentially the war in Iraq was an effort to make sure that the Iraqi oil never flowed into the general pool, as it were?
There were two things that were in the secret documents that were created by the James Baker Institute. James Baker, you know, is the lawyer for Exxon and the government of Saudi Arabia and for the Republican Party. And senior counsel to Carlyle Group, you know, so he's got it all covered.
And consigliere, Bush family consigliere.
And consigliere, right. And with a joint secret committee formed with the Council on Foreign Relations. I know, God, I sound like one of those kind of right-wing guys with the Illuminati and all that, but it's really true. And they said they came out as soon as Bush was elected or selected, I should say, in December of 2000. they met. And they began coming up with a plan because they said,
"Well, didn't Baker go
oil
down?
Markets
wait a minute,
will never...
wait a minute. Didn't Baker go down to Florida?
Oh yeah.
So he was actually part of the making Bush president thing as well.
He wasn't part of it. He did it. In fact, one thing I have about in the book is that Baker, when he was in Moscow, told a bunch of Russian oligarchs, oil industry guys.
Uh-huh.
He said twice as kind of a joke, but who was laughing? You know, because not all these guys knew who James Baker was. And he said, well, I'm the guy that fixed the election for George Bush.
You're kidding. He
and
actually
used
said that?
He phrase twice.
Wow.
And
so the Russians get to hear the truth, but we know.
And as Freud would say, there are no jokes. So this is the guy that made sure that we had a president, but who's president? Big Oil. And their plans were very fascinating to me. I actually, by the way, met, and you'll see in the book, I met with the ex-CEO of Shell Oil that Bush sent into Baghdad. I mean, this guy's so important. He got his own C-17 to fly in to take control of the oil industry. And the key thing was to make sure that Saddam had been, to put an end to the system where Saddam was jerking the world's oil markets up and down, pulling oil in and out.
Mm.
And to make sure that there would be there had been a plan afoot by neocons to, in fact, boost Iraq's oil production to 6 million barrels a day and destroy OPEC. Big Oil said, that ain't happening, to use the CEO from Shell Oil's phrase.
Uh-huh.
You know, that would not happen on my watch. End of statement.
Wow.
You know, and see, once we got the secret plans, you have to understand, then they kind of opened up because they wanted to explain what they were doing. I also, well, they want to explain, but not necessarily publicly. They wanted me to understand. What they didn't understand is that Greg Palast has this habit of wearing a wire, which I can't do for U.S. news outlets, but I can do for the British news outlets.
Oh, really?
I secretly tape, I secretly record, I secretly film.
Do you kind of walk funny? Do you have to, or do you get used to it?
Well, it depends where you put the recorder, man. Actually, my funniest is when I was going to meet Pat Robertson. You know, Pat, you'll see in the book, I talk about why they wanted, I have a section in the book called The Assassination of Hugo Chavez in Armed Madhouse. And maybe when I come to Portland, I'll bring some of these documents. Because I just met last month with Hugo Chavez. And
this
stuff. Yeah. And
is he crazy or is he crazy or not?
Well, he is crazy in a certain way. Anyone who takes on the Bush regime is asking for it. I mean, I said, are you loco? You know, I mean, you got to be nuts, man.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting because we have Pat Robertson who said, you know, Hugo Chavez thinks you're trying to assassinate him, and I think we ought to go ahead and do it. And so the reason is explained in the book. Hugo Chavez has more oil than Saudi Arabia, and he's willing to sell it to us, he told me, cheaper than Saudi Arabia.
Mm.
Take a buck a gallon off your
off the pump price. Yeah,
but he said, "Here's the deal: I'll give you the oil. I'll give it to you cheap. But what you ain't getting are the petrodollars. See what the Saudis do." Is they basically we have a big oil tax imposed by George Bush. He allows the price of oil to go up to promotes it going up to $3 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
Big oil takes a big slice. Saudis take a little slice by their 45th Rolls Royce for King Abdullah.
Right.
And then the rest of the money returns to the United States in the form of U.S. Treasury bill purchases. We have George Bush has run up a $2 trillion debt, supposedly stone sober. 100% paid for by foreign borrowings. The keystone are these petrodollars. So basically, you're taxed at the pump to pay for the deficits, rather than taxing the. You know, we get rid of the inheritance tax.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make up for that by charging at the pump, so that it circles back around as a debt to Saudi Arabia, $750 billion to China.
So wait a minute. Let me make sure I understand this correctly. So it's an incentive for foreign governments to buy U.S. Treasury bills because. Essentially, they have to have dollars in order to purchase petroleum on the open market.
Yes, or in the case of the oil nations, like the OPEC nations,
right.
they take a slice. Now, remember, Saudi Arabia would never give a nickel to for its Muslim brothers, except a few nickels would be the right way to put it. I mean,
yeah.
They could. For example, there's a lot of discussion about the Palestinian Authority running $1 billion short because of lack of funds. That's about, given that Saudi Arabia and the Emirates collect about $1 billion a day for their oil, they could take care of Palestinian economic woes in a day, literally. They won't. Because the money has to be returned. The deal is the money has to be returned back to buy U.S. Treasury bills.
To hold up our economy.
To keep the party going.
Keep the party going.
Yeah.
Which party, though? And that's the problem. So Chavez says, I'm not going to give you the petrodollars. He pulled $20 billion out of the U.S. Federal Reserve and gave it to Argentina, which also undermined the IMF, which was trying to squeeze Argentina to death.
Mm-hmm.
So the New World Order is being changed thereby. So now we get back to Pat Robertson and going undercover. When I met with Robertson, I brought my wire, and... He had me go through a metal detector, and they had some beefy guy in a weird uniform, and so
onward Christian soldier.
And I said, "Would you mind holding my lighter? Because it'll just set off the alarm."
Mm.
And of course, the lighter was my recorder.
Right, of course.
And the odd thing, the guy didn't notice that. Of course, I had no cigarettes. Just a live asthma. I can't smoke, but I did have a lighter, right? I said, "Would you hold it?" And he said, "Here's your lighter. Don't forget your lighter." And I couldn't do that for a U.S. newspaper. But that's very important to get the stories because, believe it or not,
mm-hmm.
they lie to you. In fact, when I first reported about the secret oil documents, the secret documents of big oil that were written for the Bush administration, I was... they called up Harper's Magazine, where I first reported one of these stories,
mm-hmm.
and threatened to sue James Baker Institute mm-hmm. and James Baker's people and another big oil company executive, and I won't name him, mm-hmm. And they threatened to sue Harper's. They said, in one case, they said, I never even met with the guy. I never spoke to him, and how could I quote him?
Because you had a recorded conversation.
And then, so they never met Greg Pallas. They don't know what he was saying. And then the other one, James Baker's people said, he got it all wrong, blah, blah. And so we just said, well, tell us what's wrong with, what's wrong with this recording. And so, let's go to the videotape,
right.
Shall we? So, so that's what you get in armed manhouse. You get the tape, you get the actual words, you get how these guys talk inside, you get the actual documents. And what I like, going back to that New York Times letter,
mm-hmm.
is that the guy had it. Bush hasn't screwed up. It was $18 a barrel oil when he took office.
Mm-hmm.
It's $70 barrel now. That's mission accomplished. Okay, mission accomplished. They shoplifted. You know, there's a section Kerry won about the shoplifting of the 2004 vote. 2000. You know, people know Greg Pallas' story from a lot of your listeners. I uncovered the story about how the Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris scrubbed tens of thousands of black voters off the voter rolls in 2000 before the election. Michael Moore put that on the screen. Thank God. And instead of leading to reform, it led to new forms of voter heist, and that's now the mainstream media, by the way, I just got called by Tribune newspaper in Chicago, where they're more than happy to accept that, yes, I nailed them, exposed the 2000 theft. But 2004 is still a step too far. So in a couple of years, they'll recognize that 2004 was stolen, but by then, 2006 and 2008 will be in pocket. And one of the reasons I really emphasize the elections chapter in this book and the Oregon Voter Coalition is supporting the event in Portland,
mm-hmm.
or I should say Oregon Voter Rights Coalition,
mm-hmm.
Is that they have the tricks that they're preparing for 2008 are now naked and available for review if you do enough investigating.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to discuss those. Might as well report. This time I'd like to report the theft in advance, and maybe it might prevent it. So
let me ask you this. Why, I think I know the answer, but just naively, what's the story with the Democrats? Why do they let this stuff go down?
That's another advertisement for our Madhouse Chapter 4. Called Dems and Drag.
Dems and Drag.
Dems and Drag. When the Democratic concession of 2008, when Democrats hold firing squads or in circles, I mean, Democrats don't stand up for the same reason jellyfish don't, because they're invertebrates, some of them. Though I did get a nice note from Howard Dean, by the way, the day before yesterday, I have to say. But he kind of gets it, but that won't mean much. All politics is local. And I go into New Mexico where, George Bush supposedly won New Mexico by 5,000 votes. And then I find 30,000 missing votes for John Kerry. Well, you can understand Ohio and Florida. It's run by literally the campaign chairman of the Bush reelection campaign.
Yes.
New Mexico is run by a Hispanic Democrat, supposedly, Bill Richardson.
Yeah.
What happened? And I even talk about how Richardson, like, moved heaven and earth to prevent the count of all of the missing ballots.
Yeah,
and
why?
And the answer is all politics is local. There's so much Democrats basically are so focused on maintaining their little principalities. Plus, you got the problem that guys like Bill Richardson, these kind of Democratic Leadership Conference Democrats,
mm-hmm.
for the most part, would never get. Would never get nominated in Democratic Party primaries if you had a full minority and activist vote counted. It's not their votes that have been thrown away. You know, yes, okay, what does Bill Richardson care if John Kerry gets New Mexico's electoral votes? That's really secondary compared to his own agenda, which at that moment was getting rid of certain party operatives he didn't like. So what happens is, Bill Richardson, and this gets back to class war. Bill Richardson is, I'm I'm nonpartisan in all this stuff. I mean, you know, I have to go after both parties on this because he's not, yeah, he's a Hispanic American because his mom was born in Mexico, no question. But before he was governor, he was a partner of Henry Kissinger and Kissinger Associates. So he's really much more a Kissinger American than a Hispanic American. And Kissinger Americans, their votes always count. They don't have to worry about the new ID requirements, which will knock out a half million Hispanic voters. That's a guarantee for 2008. Mm. A guarantee. But, you know, Bill Richardson has his chauffeur to vouch for him and his country club membership card, and, you know, so there won't be any, you know, there won't be any problem for Bill Richardson voting. But not every Hispanic American is also a Kissinger American.
Yeah, I have another take on this, not disagreeing with you at all. But it seems to me that the Democratic Party, as a bureaucracy, is more interested in maintaining the power of those who are at the top of the party than winning elections. Is that possibly true?
Well, actually, I talk in the book about going into the Democratic Party headquarters back in 2002 to discuss, to get their, you know, as a journalist, to get their reaction to the what appears to be a new forming. Basically, I got the information that the purge of black voters was starting up again.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted the Democratic Party's reaction to it. And I walked in, and I'm telling you, it felt like the French imperial colonial headquarters in Vietnam about 1954.
Oh no!
you know, not realizing that their days were numbered. You know, and like all these people running around with Blackberries, very self-important, and all these plans for losing elections in their hands. And you know, just one paper shuffler after another. I was looking around at this gigantic losing machine.
Yeah.
You know, which you know had nothing to do with trying to figure out how to protect the votes of the black and Hispanic voters, because it wasn't their people. You know, I mean, that's not the elite. It's not their votes. It may be their party, but it's not the kind of their votes or their voters.
Mm.
And it's very, very difficult. I mean, look, not every, you know, it's a broad brush. I mean, you know, Howard Dean literally carried around my old book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, in his briefcase. And when he told me that, I said, yeah, sure. And then he pulled it out to show me. You know, I just thought, oh, he's jiving a journalist, right?
Mm-hmm.
He had it well marked, you know. But on the other hand, and Democracy, his group, Democracy for America, is a co-sponsor of the tour with KBOO.
And the Portland Alliance and the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition.
And that's right. And, so
and we want to remind
it's
people.
It's not like people are in a complete coma.
Yeah.
And we win, you know, I spoke to Jesse Jackson this weekend. He said, we march, we win. He said, we'll win this one. I mean, that is, we'll stop these shenanigans at some point. Then they'll come up with a new trick. It's not complete doom, man. Otherwise, I would just curl up in fetal position and forget it.
Wait a minute, it's not going to
Portland, Oregon. I mean, I'm telling you, the international launch of this book, and it looks like we are going to be back on the bestseller list. I'm not sure. And that's why I'm going to say something very, very craven. If you have any mind at all to buy Armed Madhouse, order it now, and this week or next week in Portland. And by the way, try to get it beforehand, it's going to be difficult. Do yourself a favor. Try to get this book ordered, and I'll come and sign it. Because if we can get this thing, you know,
oh, it's like the opening
the
week on
done
the
now,
movies.
It'd be really good. And the reason is, I'm, you know, Ann Coulter's releasing her book on the same day. The official launch is June, is the next day, not the Portland 5th, but mm-hmm. the official launch is the 6th. And so Ann Coulter is releasing her book on 06-06-06 in honor of her father's birthday.
And her father's Satan?
that's just a rumor.
Okay.
I don't know what his or her birthday really is. But the you know, she's backed by a multi-million-dollar right-wing campaign. The left, it's just going to be us folk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, one of the reasons I'm doing this and I'm allowed to actually have this gathering in Portland,
mm-hmm.
Despite it being the night before the official book launch, is mm-hmm. that it's a fundraiser for these progressive voter protection groups, and you know, so we can, you know, we'll put together they'll put together their Krugerrands and bullion, and we'll put together our nickels. And we will win.
Yeah, I don't want you to go away. I want you to stay, but I want to remind people. You're Greg Palast. On June 5th, you're going to be talking about your book, Armed Madhouse. This is Monday, June 5th. The doors open at 6:30. It's 7 o'clock. It's $8 to $15 sliding scale. It's a benefit for the Alliance. It's sponsored by the Portland Alliance, the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition, and KBOO. And it is going to be an incredibly exciting event. The last time you were in town...
By the way, is that the first Unitarian Universalist Church?
Yes.
12th Street at Salmon, right?
Right, exactly. And that's their other hall, other than their old-fashioned nice church. It's their other church, but it's a...
12th Street and Salmon.
Yes.
6:30 p.m. Monday.
Yeah, and people should really come, and really nobody's going to be turned away, folks. I mean, we need a huge audience. We want people to buy this book. I am a sponsor. The last time you were in town, you and I had a drink. I don't know if you remember that, at Higgins after your appearance at Portland State.
I certainly do.
I think more than one drink. But anyway,
but anyway,
I think it's really... Greg, every time I talk with you, every time we have an exchange, I learn stuff that I didn't know, and I like to think of myself as really on top of the news.
He does like to think of himself that way.
Well, I mean, I learn stuff, too. I mean, one of the reasons I do this investigative reporting is that I find it fascinating. I mean, like I said, I thought, blood for oil, and then I find out it's blood for no oil, which is kind of worse. And,
well, that is really bizarre.
The suppression of oil production out of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go into, so you learn things you didn't expect, plus... Very frankly, you think, well, yeah, they fixed the vote again in 2004. But then when you find out how it's done and get into details, because, we spent so much time. It's also important for getting your facts together in the sense of, we spent so much energy trying to stop them from stealing the vote by computer, as if there was going to be Karl Rove and Lex Lothar in a cave underneath the... Washington pressing a button and changing all the Kerry votes to Bush. It was cruder... more awful than that, and 3.6 million votes were cast and never counted in the 2004 election. And it is just simply unreported. I mean, I should say not unreported. I mean, you can read Greg Palast's reports in The Guardian. You can read,
The Conyers report.
Yeah, and read the Conyers report. You get a lot of, Conyers have known for a while. The Congressional Black Caucus, by the way, is buying 1,000 books because I don't know what they're going to do. Maybe they're going to, march down 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and throw the books at the White House.
Yeah, Bush doesn't read, though.
Yeah, they're all colored in anyway. And by the way, that's the other thing, is that at the beginning, I don't know if you noticed, at the beginning of the book, there is the four-color chart of the secret history of the war over oil in Iraq, which is glued to the inside cover there so that my capitalist pig publisher is afraid that people will rip it out and shop one at Barnes & Noble or something. But you get all these illustrations. You actually get the documents. I mean, that's what I like. I enjoy getting those documents, man. That's super fun, including, the ones with, Arnold, the secret meeting of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Ken Lay.
Been reading your website recently.
Man, oh, man, that stuff. And then the letter of Ken Lay to George Bush telling him who the regulator should be. Al Capone used to have to buy the judges. Ken Lay had them appointed. And, you get the story. They're still not giving you in the press about Enron and Ken Lay.
All right, I got a question. Why is the American press so cowardly? Or so unwilling to report the news?
Lots of reasons. And, everyone has their conjecture. And there's sophisticated stuff about, who owns the media. But you know what? There's a lot of ugly careerism out there.
Ah.
I mean, tell me exactly. Brian Williams was just lauded as the new great voice of American television. Exactly what story has he ever reported? What fact has he ever uncovered? What politician, what corporate chief has he ever made uncomfortable for even 11 seconds?
But he looks good.
The hair,
right?
Man.
Well, I mean, when you say he looks good, you mean the seven pieces that they brought from the different places and sewed together in the alien marketing department. Come on. You notice that there's never a profile of Brian Williams because you never see him from the back because those guys have never sealed up the gears, man.
Newsbot 2000.
Okay, there is. So the idea is that careerism is all based on getting your teeth capped and wearing that wig and reporting and looking very solemn when you report the stories. I mean, the one thing, by the way, I like about BBC, the one thing I can do in my book, is this is really hard investigative reporting, but it also has my absolute worst jokes. And BBC will let me report the grimmest story, but in a manner which...
Wait a minute, your worst joke?
My worst jokes.
I want to hear your worst joke.
No, there's many. There's many.
I believe you.
Like I talk about Ken Lay running, you know, one thing Ken Lay did that was very smart. Before he committed his crimes, he ran a tort reform campaign with George Bush. He got Bush to actually call special session of the Texas legislature for tort reform so that he wouldn't be sued when he got caught. Isn't that great? I mean, he changed all these laws. He commit, you know, it was, you know, it used to be illegal to commit a crime. It used to be illegal for power companies to commit politicians under Franklin Roosevelt's laws. Lay got that repealed. He got all these laws repealed. He committed these crimes and got the laws repealed, and then he wanted to not get sued, so he had tort reform. So I do have, you know, that tort reform has absolutely nothing to do with putting prostitutes on the straight and narrow.
I think that has
got to be the worst. I actually had my...
That's a very bad
my
joke.
My editor get on his knees
tort
and
reform.
Beg me to take that out.
Well, perhaps that he was a bit of a tort himself.
I think a point you make on your website, pretty tellingly, is that Lay, when he's finally busted, was busted...
My website, by the way, is www.gregpowell.com.
Yes. He was busted not for ripping off consumers, but for ripping off the ownership class.
Yeah. I mean, he violated the club of the code. The code of the club, I should say, which is that he was only charged, not for his big crimes, of stealing $9 billion from California consumers. That's a big one. But that would have involved, of course, calling Ken Lay calling Dick Cheney and Arnold Schwarzenegger to the stand, as
right.
I explained.
And, of course, he also stole from Oregon, but go on.
And he stole from, big time, are you kidding?
Big time. Taxes never were paid.
And let me tell you, I used to, for those who don't know my background, I was an investigator before I was an investigative reporter. I was brought in by the Attorney General of Oregon to look at these characters. I mean, and this is a rat hole, man. Yeah, boy, you got ripped off. You're still... Don't stop putting it in past tense. You know, it's a big time rip off game, and they're not. That's why the game continueth. Okay, and there is, if you want to know how it is, there is a chapter in our madhouse called "When Arnold Got Laid," and it's about the secret meeting of Arnold Schwarzenegger and Ken Lay at the Peninsula Hotel
in Beverly Hills,
A21 Beverly Hills,
yeah.
And we got those documents. You know, again, that was fed to me by activists, but I was able to analyze this stuff. It's technical stuff.
It's a breathtaking story.
You get to find out the real, you know, I do want Arnie Schwarzenegger to explain what he did in that room. Now, he used to have these private confabs where he used to go down to his Speedos. I don't know if he did that. He went down to his moral Speedos and basically cut a deal, or appears to have cut a deal with Ken Lay, that if he became governor, that California's claim to return the money that was taken from consumers would be dropped. And indeed, as soon as he became, you know, I can't say that there was a handshake on it, but as soon as he became governor, it was effectively dropped by settling these cases for nickels on the dollar.
Uh-huh.
And you want to read that stuff because you want to read the details. In other words, it's very good to have the idea, okay, it's the big guys against us, and they rip us off, and, you know, they steal our elections, and they steal our pensions, and, you know. But I think it's important to actually have the calculations and the figures, the documents, also because it's kind of fun to look at this stuff.
Sounds like they're coming for you there.
Yes.
But that story is breathtaking in scope to me, because when you look at what actually happened, Enron and company were able to effectively hijack a governor in midterm, call a special election, oust him from office, and then fail to pay back consumers for $9 billion worth of stolen money. It's incredible.
You got a problem with that.
I do.
Oh, you know, I remember, by the way, in fact, I even paid... you had a ballot initiative for the public takeover of your Portland system.
They smashed it.
Yeah, they did.
And I have to say that I actually paid out of my own. I wrote the ballot proposition explanation of why you needed to do that, and I even paid for its placement in the ballot booklet myself.
No kidding.
I thought it was my donation to Portland. Just because, you know, I actually wrote a book for a worst seller besides my bestseller for the United Nations on this topic. But so you're not... But it's very important that you get exactly how they did it, and including, like I say, changing the laws changing the laws. For example, you know, like I say, Franklin Roosevelt had a law that said power companies could not make payments to politicians. I mean, no soft money, no hard money, no money, period.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Ken Lay, despite that law, became the number one campaign contributor to the Bush family campaign. So how did that happen without breaking the law? Well, the answer is I would like to question Mr. Lay about that, but that means if you charge him with that, you have to go back, and then, of course, who else has to be on the witness stand? So they didn't do that. He was never charged with his real major crimes, and therefore you got one criminal going up the river, but the one gangster, but the gang continues on. And you read about that, and it just continues. You not only have the horror show of private ownership of the electric system, but then you even have private ownership of the evacuation plans for New Orleans, which is a story that really needs to be told.
Is that in your book?
Yeah, it is. And in fact, what I have in there, I was on a hunt. You know, I actually did hurricane evacuation planning many, many years ago.
Really?
On Long Island.
Oh, you've done everything.
I used to do, because I just became a reporter a few years ago. And what happened was, I wanted to look at the New Orleans evacuation plan. How could you have bodies floating in the street? How could you have people in wheelchairs submerged?
Yeah, left behind.
Because all evacuation plans usually have lists of nursing homes, et cetera. And what I found out was that the emergency evacuation planning had been turned over by Bush's cronies had been put out to contractors the contractor that was given the contract to plan the evacuation of New Orleans in case of a hurricane,
mm-hmm.
and it was supposed to be done in 2004. Mm-hmm. The hurricane happened in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I could tell, the only their experience in emergency evacuation planning was major donations to the Republican Party.
Who is this?
And it's called Innovative Emergency Management. They were so innovative that to cover their steps, okay,
mm-hmm.
they listed in their press release that they were using James Lee Witt, who's a famed emergency manager,
mm-hmm.
as their co-contractor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Witt said he had nothing to do with these people.
Wow.
It was just in the press release so that the Bush gang and their donors could say that they actually had an expert getting this contract. Worse is that when the evacuation plan hit, I asked this company, I said, can I have a copy of that evacuation plan? What happened? They said, well, no. I said, no. I said, does it exist? Well, we can't tell you.
You're kidding.
And then they said, call FEMA. So I called FEMA, and we even issued a Freedom of Information Act request. Do you know that no one can find? I'm not talking about a plan that failed. No one can find the emergency evacuation plan for New Orleans. No one can certify that it was actually created. No one, now, one thing I know about emergency evacuation plans,
yeah.
Have you done one?
Yeah.
You can't evacuate anyone unless someone actually has the plan.
Are you suggesting the plan may not even exist at all?
Well, there's two things. One, we don't know. I can tell you that we have done, and I'm a pretty good investigator, we've done quite an investigation to try to find this plan, and no one can locate it. Go ahead, ask your federal government. No other reporters seem to have brought this up. The other is that I suspect that there is a plan, and it is so awful, so so neatly selective as to which neighborhoods would be taken care of, that they don't want you to know what they had in that plan.
But Greg,
okay, so I've had a long experience in this business. And believe me, there was a plan, and you know what? It's just like Iraq. It was mission accomplished.
Yeah, because
don't believe that it screwed up in Iraq. It was mission accomplished.
So they want to turn New Orleans into a Disneyland, basically run by a white elite with a few black people as servants. Is that the plan?
You have a very bad attitude. you have a very bad attitude, but you can definitely join the palace team. But the one thing is, when we have these suspicions, the next thing we have to do is, like, you know, we have to fan out and get the stuff. That often takes just literally months and months and sometimes a couple of years to get these documents. Now, I'm going to see you, right?
Oh, yeah, listen.
Who's sponsored, right?
Listen, if there's any luck at all, we'll even be able to greet each other and shake hands on the stage or something. Who knows?
6:30, the armed madhouse tour. Armed madhouse, who's afraid of Osama Wolf? China floats, Bush thinks, the scheme to steal 08, no child behind, left another dispatch from the front lines of class war. Go to www.gregpalace. You can hear Randy Rhodes and Larry David and Amy Goodman reading the book. And but more important is that we have work to do, because it's a meeting which is not just, you know, bulling around on this stuff. Well, it's going to be real class war boot camp. It'll be completely outrageous. It should be stupidly funny, but very important. First Unitarian Universalist Church, come out for the KBOO, Portland Alliance, Oregon Voter Rights Coalition, 12th Street and Salmon. Donation $8 to $15, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And doors open at 6:30. That's Monday. That's
Monday.
That's Monday. And I'll be there, and that will be the very actually, we will have copies of our Madhouse, because I can't tell you the fight I had with my publisher over allowing those books to be there before release date, but they will be there.
Well, hopefully we'll meet and greet.
Yes, no, that's 100%. You got it. Please come up, and we'll meet and greet the whole, all of Portland there.
All right, thank Greg Palast.
Thank you once again for joining us.
Bye.
All right.
Wow, I'm so glad.
Monday. Cool beans.
You know, he has such energy.
He does.
He's a cool guy. And our Madhouse, he's the real deal. He actually does the research. He actually does the work. He's sort of wonderfully, tenaciously a madman after the truth about this culture and this society.
Indeed. And it's a sad testimony that he really can't ply his trade here the way he should be able to.
Well, it's getting out. You
it's
know?
Getting there.
Greg
yeah.
Palast does make it onto the bestseller list every now and then.
And he makes a difference.
You know, and there's other guys who are doing interesting things as well, of course, and other women. And I think that it's important for all of you out there, within the sound of our voices, to make it down to the First Unitarian Universalist Church at 12th and is it Salmon? 12th
yeah.
and yeah, 12th and Salmon. Show up early, 6:30. Doors are going to open at 6:30.
Monday the 5th.
Monday the 5th. That's this
and,
coming Monday.
And you can meet Joe and I, and you can see why Joe is the looks and I am the brains of this outfit.
Whoa, there's an odd thought. Ooh. Okay, now, we have been talking with Greg Palast. We've been talking about an important idea, which is that, in fact, the mission was accomplished in Iraq by just stopping the, by keeping the price of, raising the price of oil way, way, way up.
Yeah, and keeping oil trading in dollars.
Exactly, and making sure those dollars stay within the context
right.
of the American Imperium.
Well, what I didn't get a chance to ask him, and I wanted to ask him, was how much credence he felt there was behind the idea that Saddam Hussein was threatening to value his oil reserves in euros rather than dollars, and that the dangerous precedent that would set.
Really?
Essentially, that would mean that foreign governments would probably stop buying U.S. Treasury bills they would no longer need dollars to buy oil on the open market.
And we talked about the screwing over the American veterans.
Yep.
And I still want to hear from vets on that issue. I know we've kind of not taken calls for a little while, but we're welcoming calls right now. 231-8187 is the number to call. This is KBOO, 90.7 on your FM dial. I'm Joe Uris. That's Abe Proctor. We just talked with Greg Palast. He, on June 5th, that's this Monday, will be at the First Unitarian Universalist Church, Southwest 12th, 1011, that's 10th, you know, 1011, how can that be? 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue in Portland. 6:30 in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
You all should show up. You should buy his book. It's going to be cool.
Yeah, I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's good. He's very funny.
Yep.
Very funny guy.
Yep. And, you know, he can meet us. Finally put faces to the voices.
Well, he knows me.
Okay. Oh, no. I'm saying our listeners can meet us.
Oh, the listeners can meet us.
Yeah.
I'm not
it's not
sure.
all about us, Joe.
Oh, I thought it was.
There's people out there who hear us, too.
And they want to meet us?
Yeah, I
Why?
Imagine
Would
some of them
want
do.
To meet me? I don't.
Okay, because we're glamorous.
Oh, and... Glamorous. Oh, that is very funny. Yeah, you know, I'm 6'2", tan but not too tan.
Uh-huh. Very Aryan looking.
Yeah, with blonde hair, blue eyes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
About 35.
Yeah. I'm about 5'4". Very. 231-8187 is the number to call. Please call away. Hey, we got a caller. Who's who do we have? Oh, okay. Well, we got Janet working the board for us. Thank you, Janet. All right.
Surprise caller. Hi.
Hey, a mystery caller.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, I'm a Vietnam era veteran. And,
great.
I went through a lot of the GI Bill.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have a university degree without it.
Uh huh.
And you know, that's just one point of what these guys are trying to do. And I think the obscenity of cutting veterans' benefits when kids are coming home maimed is just beyond belief.
Yeah.
But I think all of this, including Katrina, is part of a plan. And I think part of the plan in Katrina was to destroy a democratic enclave, for one. The other was to discredit FEMA in the eyes of the country, to demonstrate over and over again that ordinary people can't rely on their government.
Right, and the private sector is always better.
No, that's a very good point. Yeah. If you discredit the government entirely, people stop having any faith in the government, and then you can even more put everything in the private sector.
Yeah, so no matter how bad these guys look in the press, they win because that's actually their goal.
Very good point.
Agreed. And it's much easier to pull something off like that when, in the first place, you believe that the only purpose of government is to funnel public money into the hands of the private sector. And once you believe that to begin with, it's so much easier to do all this other stuff that you just mentioned.
Yeah, so that's all I've got this morning.
I really appreciate it. I'm really glad you called, and it's good to hear from a veteran of that era.
And please find a way to rebroadcast your program in the evening when more people can hear it.
We would love to do that, but, you know, we've got a lot of people on the air here, and they all have a goal. But I want to ask you, before you run away, if you're still there, are you there?
Yeah, still here.
Okay. Do you know of any veteran coming home from the Vietnam experience who was spat upon or cursed?
No, I don't. As a matter of fact, I was lucky in that I didn't get caught up in that. I had joined before it started.
Ah.
And got out about a year after the Gulf of Tonkin, and I was involved in all the stuff up in the Park Blocks in 68, and, you know, just a process of re-education. So I don't know anybody personally who had that experience.
Is it possible it never happened?
I think it happened in the same, well, I don't know if you watched the thing last night on Channel 10, but the thing that took place at one of the universities when the cops came in and there was another cop riot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's basically the context in which it's like that happened, you know, in extreme situations where demonstrators and protesters were being attacked, and there were those kinds of confrontations. I think actually very little of that happened, even though I was completely against what was going on then. I have always felt like those kids were so brave, and they deserve any kind of support that could be given to them afterwards, the kids that were suckered into that stuff. And watching the program on the Black Lions last night.
Yeah.
And looking at the photographs of these kids was just heartbreaking because they're just so young.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing it to them all over again. And I have this fantasy about Bush coming to town and holding an open public forum and having the opportunity to get up and ask him if this is such a valiant cause and so important to our national security, why his daughters aren't serving.
That's a nice fantasy.
You know, there was
I'd love to confront that.
Yeah, there was an April Fool's story being circulated on the net that they had joined up.
Yeah.
Ha.
Yeah. I'd just love to have an opportunity to nail him to the wall publicly.
Okay, man, I really appreciate your comments.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for the call. Vietnam
vet. Right. Yeah.
Cool guy. Steve.
Good morning.
Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hello.
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 Hi.
Shoot. Go ahead. Steve?
Yeah.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call.
Oh, you bet.
Sure.
Are you guys saying that government does a better job than private sector?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
And wait, not in every aspect.
Give me an example.
Public power.
Health care.
Those are two examples.
Have you ever lived in Canada?
No.
I lived there for 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
We had people crossing the border into Washington State and Seattle to get their health care because the wait in Canada was so long just for a simple checkup. And our taxes were astronomical. We were in even the poor were in a 28% tax bracket.
Okay, now let me respond to that very carefully because you're raising a really good point.
Okay.
First of all, the fact that a system is run by the private or the public sector does not per se make it an efficient system. That's not the argument.
I agree.
That's not the argument. The argument, though, in terms of the large picture is that if you look at Canada or France or Germany or Italy or Denmark or any of the Scandinavian countries, for example, all of which have a single-payer system, every single one of them has, first of all, a lower infant mortality rates, lower morbidity rates, longer life expectancy, lower general illness rates, lower incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, lower incidence of all kinds of things. In other words, those systems in the aggregate are actually, and it's the only way to measure healthcare, by the way, not by personal experience, but by the aggregate. In the aggregate, those societies, it turns out, are healthier.
Okay, let me respond to that.
Sure.
You said lower sexual transmitted disease, a higher mortality rate.
Lower mortality rate.
A lower mortality rate.
Yeah.
Would you not agree with me that our eating habits in the United States are a lot worse and unhealthier than most of these nations?
But yeah, I'm sure. Yes.
And our promiscuity would attribute to the sexually transmitted diseases?
No. Yes, I agree that our eating habits are worse here in this country. We really statistically, our young people are really not all that more or less promiscuous than young people in other countries. Young people
but
in other countries...
They are a lot less healthy. In fact, I saw a program on OPB not too long ago. A physician on there was saying that for the first time in the history of the United States, this younger generation is not going to outlive their parents because of how they eat.
Yes,
I mean, look at the garbage that our fat little kids are eating today.
Yeah, I agree with you there. But I think that fact in the context of this conversation doesn't carry a whole lot of weight. Because as Joe mentioned, you measure a healthcare system in the aggregate. You say that there's long lines for simple checkups in Canada. However, I'd say that situation is preferable to tens of millions of people going without healthcare at all, which is something you have here in this country.
Well, why not then make... I listen to Clark Howard a lot, okay? A very conservative economist who basically wants everybody to save money. And he brought up a very good point on this. He would rather than the government run it, he would rather have the government make a law where everybody had to be covered and go out and get their own coverage. And he believes that if that happens, there's been studies done on this, that if everybody was forced to buy health care, the cost of health care would actually go down in
cost. Well, he's probably right.
I've never seen the government run anything efficiently.
How about public? Oh, again, let's change areas. How about public power in Washington State compared to the cost of electricity in Oregon? Or how about the cost of electricity in the SoCal region, which is public, compared to the cost of electricity in those areas in Southern California where it isn't?
How about Medicare, where administrative costs are a small fraction of administrative costs in private sector health care?
Or how about the disastrous effort to have a pass-through by the drug companies for medicines for old people instead of having a massive buying of the medicines the way the VA does?
Well, again, I don't have any answers on that. I don't have any information on that.
Okay.
As a small business owner,
uh-huh.
okay,
mm-hmm.
and I look at what government does on a daily basis,
mm-hmm.
and I can't afford to have the waste that government does, because the government, it seems like the government has an endless supply of money, because if they need more money, they just tax us more.
Well,
okay?
Look.
I have a limited money. I mean,
they tax you more, but they don't tax the rich more.
Well, you know what? Sure they do.
No, yeah. they don't.
No.
No, they don't, man.
There's just another tax cut just went through Congress last week that mostly benefited
the
upper one-half of 1% of income earners.
But listen, the rich are in a higher tax bracket. They're up to 30%.
Yeah, well, you can afford 30% when you bring in seven figures a year.
Or eight.
But they still pay more.
Yeah, they do. Of course they pay more because they earn more.
Well...
But you're
the ones that provide the work.
No. Listen, actually, you know this. You know, in fact, that the great bulk of work in society is provided by small businesses.
By people like you.
Let me finish. You also know you're being taxed to death. And that makes you very...
I don't think I'm being taxed to death.
Well, but you're being taxed.
You're
being overtaxed. And you know that this is harmful to your business bottom line. What you need to do, and I think everybody should do this, don't believe us, just simply look at the structure of the tax system and look at where it has shifted in the last 20 years. And it's not just Republicans. Democrats have done this as well.
Well, that's what That's why I agree in a in a flat tax, either a flat tax system or a national sales tax.
Okay, man. We're going to have to agree to disagree and give some other folks a chance, okay?
What's your opinion on that?
A flat tax, I'm against it. Sales tax, you'd have to talk me heavy to persuade me.
Well, then everybody would pay their fair share.
Well, no, actually, poor people would pay even more. Because, for example, oh, we're running out of time. We'll have to argue this another time.
All
listen,
right, have a good day.
Thanks a lot for the call. That's a good call.
Yeah, it was a good call.
It's an interesting call. So, I want to repeat. Greg Palast, this Monday, June 5th, on Madhouse, great book, at 7 p.m., doors open at 6:30 at the First Unitarian Universalist Church out there, Southwest 12th Street campus. And the contribution is $8 to $15. Palast is great. It's a benefit for the Portland Alliance. It's sponsored by the Alliance, by the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition, and by us.
All right.
And apparently we're going to be there.
Apparently so.
We'll get to meet and greet.
Yeah.
So if you want to see what my handsome partner really looks like, are you going to wear a bag over your head this time?
I'm the brains.
You're going to wear the bag over your head this time? All right. And I also want to remind people that at 11 o'clock, Amy Goodman's on here.
Yep.
You know, Democracy Now, great show.
All right. Well, we're out of time.
We'll
see you Monday.
All right. Take care.
Bye.